Slide one, page one. I'll try to call out page numbers as I'm going through so you can follow along. Starts off with just a review of the agenda that I would like to present. And I wanted to start off with presenting the July 1, 2016 valuation results, which we completed last summer, and then a preliminary July 1, 17 results. The July 1, 17 results are obviously based on the final assets as of July 1, 2017, but because we haven't started the valuation process on the liabilities, it's a roll forward of the liabilities. But it should give us an idea of where we're at based on the rate of return on assets for the last plan year. And I'll touch on the three main results, which are the funded status of the plan, the actuarially calculated contribution rate, and then just a review of some of the main actuarial assumptions and methods that go into those calculations, just as background information. And at any point in time, you can stop and ask me for a little bit more clarity. Sometimes it's hard to know exactly how much detail or explanation to go into some of this stuff, and it's perfectly fine if you need me to put in a little bit more detail.
And I
would
just say also, my finance director mentioned any interaction or questions that you all are the experts, so your questions will help us can answer, so feel free to interact with that.
And then I wanted to move on and hit on some historical results of the pension plan to kind of see where you've come from, how you've gotten to this point, and kind of discuss maybe why we're at where we're at as an explanation. And then thirdly, I would like to just start with a broad conversation about some discussions of how to control costs and plan design aspects of controlling costs into the future. That can obviously be a very broad discussion with a lot of different points to touch on. And so I try to stay a little broad, but to focus on a couple of points to consider to keep it from getting too far off into the weeds. But that on that point, I think I'm much more open to back and forth if you have any questions or ideas. Okay. Then jumping in on slide two, there's a table here with lots of pretty numbers on it for the July 1, 2016 and July 1, 2017 results. I point out a couple of it, the actuarially accrued liabilities, that's the liabilities that we calculate for the pension plan as of our valuation date. And we're showing that they were about $30.5 million as of 7/1/16, increasing about $1 million to $31.8 million for July 1, 17. Now again, that is a roll forward, not based on the actual census data as of the end of the year. So in so much that new people have come on and old people have retired unexpectedly, that might change a bit, but we don't expect it to change significantly. The assets, we have two different asset values. We have a market value of assets and an actuarial value of assets. The market value of assets is as you would expect. It's the value of the assets as of the end of the plan year, showing a nice bump up from 7/1/16 to 7/1/17, which we estimate is around a 10.5% return. The actuarial value of assets is something that we use to do most of the calculations for the pension plan. The actuarial value of assets is a smoothed actuarial value of assets over 5 years. So in so much that the actual return is higher or lower than the 7% assumption, then we recognize that difference over 5 years. And that is intended to smooth out some of the inherent volatility in the market value so that in years where there's a big loss, you don't have to feel that pain as quickly. Or where in years that there's a gain, like this last year, you don't get all of the benefit right away. But the hope is that it leads to a little bit of a smoother path going forward for the funded status and the contribution rate. the difference between the actuarial liability and the actuarial value of assets, it's called the unfunded actuarial accrued liability, which actually went down a little bit between 7116 and 7117 due to the good return on assets. And similarly, the funded percentage is based on the liability and actuarial value of assets increased a little bit from 66 to 68. Finally, we come to the actuarial calculated contribution rate. And I break it out into three main pieces that go into the calculation of the contribution rate. The normal cost. The normal cost is the value of benefits expected to be accrued in the next year. So for the contribution, we expect you to want to fund them as they are accruing. And so the normal cost is the value of benefits that you're going to accrue for the next year. And that is, you know, what we want to fund. Then there's an expense assumption, which is rounded to 0.05. It's $45,000 a year that we expect. And that's kind of based on the non-investment expense assumption. So that'd be actuarial, legal, administrative, things like that. And then finally is the unamortized, or the amortized value of the unaccrued, or of the unfunded actuarial liability. So the unfunded actuarial liability is amortized currently over 20 years. And so this is the value of that amortization payment for the next year to pay off the existing $10 million unfunded liability at the moment. We add up all of those dollar values and come up with a total actuarial calculated contribution as a dollar amount. But then, because we understand that the county prefers to contribute on a percentage of pay basis, we convert that to a rate based on expected payroll for the year. Now this is based on the census data as of, you know, the actuarial evaluation date. So we understand that it can go up or down based on retirements, new hires, pay raises, different than our assumption. But that's where we come up with the contribution rate, is by taking the dollar value calculated and converting it based on expected base pay. Are there any questions about what I've gone over so far? Going on then, we'll go into some detail on page 3 about the actuarial calculated contribution rate. So as I touched on already, it's made up of three main pieces. The normal cost, which is the cost of the benefits expected to be earned the next year. So you're funding benefits as they are earned by people. And now this is partially funded by the employee's 6% contribution rate that they make. It doesn't fund all of it because it comes up to be more than the 6% of payroll cost, as we'll see in a little bit. But the 6% does partially fund it from the employees. Second is the provision for non-investment expenses, which is currently $45,000 a year. And then third is the amortization of the unfunded actuarial liability, which I said again is currently 20 years. In the past, it's been 30 years, as high as 30 years. And at one point where there was in 2009, where you were dealing with the recession and the bad rate of return on assets, that base was amortized over 25 years to kind of smooth out the pain of that one bad year. But generally, going forward now, it's a 20-year amortization payoff basis. And then we, as I said, convert it to a percent of payroll basis. Slide 4 shows, again, the pieces of that actuarially calculated contribution rate, both in dollars and as percent of pay. And what I wanted to point out on this slide 4 is that, as I mentioned before, the normal cost is about 15.3% of payroll. So the 6% pays off, you know, some of that, but the other part, the 9.3%, is covered by the county. So the employees are not covering in their 6% contribution rate the full cost of the benefits that they are accruing. Moving on then, slide 5. I'll just kind of touch on some of the main actuarial assumptions and methods that go into these calculations. You know, as actuaries, we have to make assumptions about what will happen in the future, because the actuarial liability is essentially the present value of all future benefit payments out 80 years. And so we have to assume what will happen for the next 80 years for the people that are currently retirees or working today. And so we assume, you know, the big one, how long they live. So the longer they live, the more they're expected to be paid from the retirement plan, so the higher their liability. We assume how long they will work for the county before retiring. So the longer they work for the county, the higher the benefit, the higher the liabilities. Similarly, we assume what the payroll, their salaries will increase as they continue to work for the county, because the benefit is based on the average of the final 5 years of their employment. So even somebody who's young now, in their 20s and 30s, their benefit, we want to know what it will be when they retire when they're 60 or 65, because their pay will obviously be much higher when they're 60 or 65, and so we want to fund the value of that starting now. Does that kind of make sense? The three main methods are the asset method, the actuarial cost method, and the amortization method. Now, I've already touched on this a little bit. The asset method is the five-year smoothing of the assets intended to slowly recognize over 5 years any rates of return that are different than the current 7% assumption. So, for instance, you earned about 10.5% this year, that if excess 3.5% return will now be smoothed into the assets over the next 5 years to give you a bump in the future if you have bad returns next year. That. Similarly, in prior years during the recession, when you had a year of a couple of bad returns, the main pain for that wasn't felt until, you know, it gets smoothed in over a while.
I got a quick question.
It
seems to me like you have to track somehow. I mean, if we have, there's like three different scenarios. If we have somebody that's a new hire and they're 60, it is different than somebody that's a new hire that is 30.
Exactly.
And, or somebody that's been here, whatever, you know, 30 years, you know, depending on when they're going to retire. So do you track, like, the 30-year-old that hired, how long typically they stay in employment in Morrill County?
Yes, we do. Yeah, we have assumptions based on, you know, how old they are when they were retired, the likelihood of them staying around until they reach retirement age. Now, if they're already at retirement age, you know, because they were hired, you know, older with a 60-year-old, then they have a different kind of set of assumptions for them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's built in.
That is built in, yeah.
Can I ask, so those assumptions are based on Morrill County employees or just in general?
So the likelihood of terminating before retiring and the likelihood of making it to retirement age and retiring is based on Morrill County experience. It's based on Morrill County experience. I was going to say, I think maybe we used a base table and then adjusted it for Morrill County experience, but I think in both those cases they are based on actual experience, because Milliman's had the plan for dozens of years, I think 20, 25 years, and so we have many years of experience in which to draw upon. Now, obviously experience in the 90s may not be the same as the experience in the 2010s, but it gives us some basis in that assumption.
Is there's a world before, we see a lot of people retiring in 10 years.
Yes, that's kind of.
We have this time wave of things.
Yeah.
And that's what we see with the annual census.
And we do review those assumptions against actual experience every year, and we will modify that if it looks like the behavior is changing. The actuarial cost method is probably one of the more wonky actuarial things that we do. The actuarial cost method, we call it entry age normal. It's the idea of how to allocate the cost of the total expected benefit. So we make these assumptions to project an employee's benefit out into the future, and then how do you allocate that to this year? You know, because some of it hasn't been earned, some of it has been earned already. And so without getting into too much details and the weeds on this, the cost method that Morrill County uses is called entry age normal and is designed to create a level cost over base pay into the future. So we don't expect cost to increase as a percentage of pay into the future, assuming all of our assumptions are met. You know, if our assumptions are met, then the cost will remain stable. There are other cost methods that have a built-in increase, and for better or for worse, those are used in some circumstances for other clients, but the one that we use for more, I think that's the most appropriate as you contribute on a percentage of pay basis. And then finally is the amortization method, which, as I mentioned, is currently over 20 years. We use closed bases, which means every year we set up a base for the experience of that year. So there's a running list of bases that have been set up for, we started doing this about 5 years ago. And those bases are individually being paid off over 20 years. And we use a level percentage of pay amortization method so that the payment is expected to remain stable over a percentage of pay basis. Again, trying to keep that actuarially calculated contribution rate stable into the future as a percentage. The other main assumptions are the assumed long-term rate of return assumption is currently 7%, and that was lowered about 2 years ago from a previous 7.5%. Now, this is one that kind of can get some headlines for other plans, you know, big plans, because, for instance, PERS for many years was at 8%, and some people think that's way too high, and some people think actually that's maybe appropriate. But based on kind of where your assets were a couple of years ago and where the models for current expectations were, we thought lowering that assumption from 7.5 to 7 was probably appropriate. There is obviously still some downward pressure on that because, you know, expected returns, McGee can probably speak to that much more than I can, have not been, you know, improving. They kind of stay at that lower level. But for now, we think 7 is probably still a reasonable assumption. Your guys' input obviously is valuable in determining that as well. Administrative expenses, I touched on. Mortality, that's the life expectancy of your employees and retirees. Right now, it's set to an assumption that's similar to the Oregon PERS assumption. However, Morrill County doesn't assume future increases in the mortality. What that means is sometimes we want a mortality assumption that assumes people will continue to live longer into the future. So a person who's 65 today is assumed to live 20 to 30 years. Maybe a 65-year-old in 25 years would be expected to live 30 to 35 years longer. And we don't have that built into Morrill County's current assumption. And I mentioned that, you know, if you were to add that to the mortality assumption, it would increase liabilities because you're expecting people to live longer, which would also increase the calculated contribution rate. Finally, the mortality assumption, that was actually looked at a couple of years ago, I think at the same time as the long-term rate.
And it would increase with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, for now, I don't think it's... The county has such a small population in terms of like a mortality study that it would be impossible to separate some of your actual experience. But, you know, you need tens of thousands of lives in order to do your own mortality study. So it makes sense to kind of put you on a larger plan assumption. And Gordon's case seems to be the most appropriate considering, you know, the plan.
But it has been adjusted in the last 25 years.
Yes. We also assume an annual cost of living adjustment. The plan offers a cost of living adjustment to retirees with a maximum 2%, and that's what we assume will happen every year. And that's been pretty good because generally in years where inflation is less than 2%, existing retirees will still get the 2% because the assumption has a built-in accumulated shortfall where in years where inflation was, say, 3%, the retirees only got 2%. And so that 1% difference is kind of rolled forward until there's a year in which inflation was only 1%. And so that kind of is used in backfill. And then I think I've already touched on the demographic assumptions. So that's kind of a good stopping point, I think, if there are any questions about, you know, where you're at and how we got what we have to do. Yeah.
All right, so I just want to make sure I'm clear. So in retirement, on a defined benefit plan, so I get 2% increase on my defined benefit every year.
That's correct.
Medical.
Yeah, the $60 doesn't get the cold votes. It's just fine.
Right. Okay. So money.
Yeah, it's money. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, then starting on page 7, I kind of have a historical valuation results and kind of overview of the points here. The plan has had unfunded liability for many years going back. Which I think can be explained by a couple of main issues. One, asset returns that were less than the assumption. We assumed 7.5% for several years, and as you'll see, the rate of return over, you know, many years has been less than that. So assuming something higher than what you actually got leads to unfunded liability. Also, there have been some assumption changes that have contributed to it. One, mortality improvements. So when some of these liabilities were set in the past, we didn't know how much mortality improvement was going to happen. And so when you got to a point where you're like, oh my gosh, people are living longer than we expected, once you build that into the assumptions, it increased liability and increased the unfunded amount. Also, lowering the rate of return assumption a couple of years ago also increase the liability, and so again, assumption changes can affect that unfunded liability amount. And then also, contributions less than the actuarially calculated contribution rate. Historically, accounting has contributed at the full rate, but there was a period over a period of time where you weren't able to contribute at the full amount, and so much so that you can't contribute at the full amount, it increases the unfunded liability. And then the other point there is that as the plan gets bigger, as the liabilities and the assets get bigger, it becomes more susceptible to years where there's a bad rate of return. The way I think of it is that, you know, if you get a 10% loss on a $5 million trust, that's not good, but it's a bigger amount of money to lose 10% on a $25 million trust than a $5 million trust. So that's what I mean by that point. And then also you'll see, you know, the actually calculated contribution has been increasing, and that's, I think, explained by increase in unfunded liability and the short amortization period. So, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the amortization period was 30 years instead of 20 years. So the next 8, 9, and 10 are just tables of values, and I'm not going to read off all these numbers. I think you can kind of see what you're looking for in these. But I kind of take the history of the plan back to the early 2000s. On page 8, I show the actual value of assets, the accrued liability, and then the unfunded liability and funded ratio. And you can see that, you know, back in 7/1/2003, it was at 70%, and now, you know, you're still around 70%. There was a period in time where, prior to the recession, asset returns had, you know, lifted the funded rate, the funded percentage up, but then the recession knocked it back down. And I'd also like to point out that in 7/1/15, between 7/1/14 and 7/1/15, you can see the liabilities jumped about $4.3 million. And that was where we made both the assumption changes for the rate of return and the mortality. And so that's what caused that big jump in the liabilities between those 2 years. And that was just trying to reflect, you know, and what's actually happened. People are living longer, rates of return are less, you know. The next page kind of shows a historical market value of rates of return. The first column is the 1 year period for the plan year, going back to about 2000. And then the next period is the geometric average, so that the equivalent of getting that rate of return is the equivalent to geometric average. So basically, your actual returns for the last 15 years average out to about 5.2% per year. Now, obviously, that goes up and down based on, like I ran the numbers with the 10.5% for the last year, and it bumped up the 15-year average to about 6%. So, you know, that there is some volatility there. But it just goes to show you, I think what I'm trying to show is that you haven't been meeting the 7 or 7.5 on average for the last, you know, 15 years. And then page 10 kind of shows the contributions and actuarially calculated contribution rate along with the percentage contributed for the year. And, you know, as I show you, contribute 100% most years, but there was a period of time where you couldn't, and that's shown here. Also, the increase in the rate. Oh, there was one thing I wanted to point out on the actuarially calculated contribution rate. We do assume that there's a lag in the effective date. So when we calculate the actuarially calculated contribution rate for July 1, 2016, we know that you won't start contributing that amount until the next plan year. So that's why for the plan year ending June 30, 2017, we show 30.5, which was the result from our 7/1/16 evaluation. So we know that there's a lag in that. In the application of that. On page 11, I kind of try to answer a question that I thought made sense. Why did the unfunded liability increase and contribution rates increase, even though the county was contributing 100% of contributions for so many years. I mean, that question kind of popped out to me from the tables. And from what I could figure out, it seems that one, asset returns less than the assumption. You know, you're continually earning less than assumed. You continually build unfunded liability for that. Two, and this is a little wonky as well, the amortization method for paying off the unfunded liability in prior years wasn't really designed to pay it off in the short term. What you would do is that, and this is different now, isn't it? Is that each year you'd start with 30 years, the next year you re-amortize over 29 years, the next year you re-amortize over 28 years. And so it feels like you're shortening the amortization period, so you're paying it off. But because the payoff method was assumed to be a level percent of pay, the first couple of years of payments weren't paying off the interest of the existing unfunded liability. It's like a mortgage rate where you're not paying the full value of interest because you know you're going to be paying more in the future. So the unfunded liability was expected to increase for the first couple of years until the payments started ratcheting up as the base pay increased, because you're contributing on a level percentage of pay. So we changed that method 5 or 6 years ago because we recognized that it wasn't paying off the unfunded. We said, no, we're going to start producing closed bases that will be expected to be paid off into the future. And so each closed base for the experience of that year, the payments start off not paying off the interest, but increase and do pay it off in 20 years. So we've got a method now where we think that in 20 years, assuming assumptions are met, that you would be fully funded, 100% funded. Does that kind of make sense? I know that, I did have one last point. I mean, you can see that the illustration of that is, you can see in the tables, liabilities are increasing $1 to $1.5 million a year, but you're only putting in less than $700 to $1 million. And so that's kind of the illustration of that. We're calculating a rate that isn't even covering the increase in liabilities. So that's why I'm trying to say the amortization method wasn't designed to pay it off.
So where does the additional amortized amount, I mean, if you're currently contributing at 100%, there is no loan payment, if you will. Would you have to contribute 105%? Would you have to be 100% plus amortized?
So what we do when we amortize is we assume that since it's a level percentage of pay will increase into the future. So the first couple of years would not pay off even interest, but then as pay increases, the percentage of that pay increases, and so then you start paying off more interest and the principal into the future. So if you were to contribute on a level dollar value, so instead of a level percentage of pay, a level dollar value, the initial payments would be higher going into the future, and would be then a decreasing percentage of pay. Did I explain that well?
So the amortization is only helping by payroll increasing. It's not true amortization of debt, it's just assuming payroll. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, what we're trying to do in that amortization method is trying to keep the cost of the percentage of pay stable, because of a level dollar amount. $1 million over $5 million pay this year would be a 20% base pay contribution. And if it was $1 million in 20 years, payroll would increase to, who knows, but it would be a smaller percentage. And so that's kind of what we're trying to do there.
So at 4 to 5 years, you truly would start paying on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Assuming.
Yeah. And we do projections. So for the valuation for say GASB reporting purposes, we have to project out the plan's position for 30, 40, 50 years. And we can see those base pick those amortization payments being paid off in 20 years. And you get to a point in 20 years where you're 100% funded. Because we have
the payroll assumption and the 7% assumption is accurate.
Right. Yeah, you know, and I was talking to Daryl. I mean, like, we come up with assumptions, and I can guarantee our assumptions are not going to be right. Like, actual experience would be something different. But we have to come up with something, and this is our best guess, you know. You know, we're the only job maybe where we can guarantee we're going to be wrong in the future, but... You know, you have to start with something.
Took a lot of math education to get there.
Can you look at the numbers in a way that you've got current funded liability, which is current employees, and then you've got the unfunded liability that's in the projections? Can you split those out for them so they can see what this negative amortization looks like
right.
versus current funding?
Right.
I'm not sure I quite understand your question.
Well, I see it as current cash flow and long-term liability. And when we're managing the money, we've got money coming in and money going out, and for the last year, the year before, we had much more going out than was coming in. So not only is it fighting the return on the investment, but it's also fighting the cash flows. So to me, the long-term liability is one set of standards and assumptions, and current funding is another, because
yeah.
we're looking from a cash flow model as well. So is there a way to explain it in less actuarial terms so we can see it? Like, we all understand what negative mortgages look like. And we all understand what checkbook planning looks like, you know, money in, money out. And to me, you know, that's what I think they're trying to get in their mind is, you know, what does it take to make sure that the pension plan and the defined benefit plan is secure and can cash flow the current retirees, because a lot of those are on annuity payments today, not in the future, but today. And then you have the future assumptions as well. Is there a way to break it down?
So, I'm not 100% sure I quite understand the question, but I'll try. And you can correct me if I'm going off.
Anything you can offer to appreciate.
Sure. So, our liability calculations do split out the people who are expected to continue to accrue benefits, the active employees, and the retired participants who are currently getting annuity payments that are getting COLA every year as well. And when we calculate then the actuarially calculated contribution, and we kind of take into account those future accruals and the future COLAs in that liability number. And because everything is kind of designed to be as a level percentage of payroll, given that assumptions are met, the rate, the contribution rate shouldn't be increasing into the future. So, if you contribute at the actuarially calculated contribution rate, you would be paying off the unfunded liability into the future. Am I kind of answering your question?
I understand what you're saying. I think that it's hard to put it in hard dollars from a standpoint of understanding what each of those elements, how they contribute to the cash flow. So, because to me, we've got retirees on the annuity payments. And so if I had just one fund and I said I've got to cash flow those people with a 2% increase plus $60 over their life expectancy, that's a hard number. Okay, then I have future liabilities for current mine, they will say, well, where's my money? You know, I'm putting the money in, is it growing? And then we look at the return on assets, and when you're quoting return on assets, you're quoting those return on assets on a net-net basis. That's net of all cash flows, net of all expenses, and so forth. So I serve as a trustee at the Multnomah County Library. We went through this for them, and their assumptions forward-looking with the consultants, and they're forecasting a 6% 10-year equity return. So 7 is higher than we're given in other situations. So if we can never meet 7, or our 7's a stretch because we have to change the investment policy and take more risk, you know, what really is the challenge for the county to make some decisions? Would we budget current cash flow and take a look at this unfunded liability as kind of paying down that mortgage over time, and if so, what does that look like as far as catch-up? Is there a way to model that?
I think so, because I think that's the way we look at it when we project for evaluation results. We look at, you know, the money coming in and I think the current projection, I don't have it in front of me now, I can pull it up, is that, you know, in the next couple of years, there will be more money going out than coming in. I'm not 100% sure on that. But even in that case, we're projecting the plan remains solvent. It doesn't, the trust amount doesn't go to zero.
But we want it more to solve it. I'd like to see it, see what kind of a plan has to be done to bring this up to 80% funded in a reasonable time frame. What would it take to do that? That would be my bottom line.
Mine too.
Homework, sir.
I may be pushing a little hard.
No, that was what I was exactly how I wanted to ask it.
Yeah, and I guess my question is, what's a reasonable funded ratio? We're at 66% now, that seems to be too low. Just use the number 80% of that. Or we should strive to be, or should we strive to be 100%? No, that's a hard number to get to.
Well, in reality, you're closer to 70 because the fund is worth $22 million today. It had a wonderful year. But, you know, if we're 70%, wouldn't it be nicer to be 75?
Yeah.
You know, something a little bit higher. I think under 70 is scary to me. I would like to see it above that at all costs. But that's my opinion, and I'm not in your shoes.
Well, and when you're in a good scenario, good years, it seems reasonable that you wouldn't be in. I'm funded like you're in 4 years. I mean, I would see you in some years why they were there, but today I struggle with that thought.
Well, and in talking to Kate, the fact that there are how many employees are retired, a third of the employee base will be retired in the next 10 years. That's scary as well as far as outflows versus the contributions going into the money.
You know, and I've heard Kate throw that number out before, but to me that seems average. If your working life is 30 years, that approximately a third of your population should be retiring in the next 10 years anyway.
Yeah, I think I agree, but I'm just talking about distributions and what will be going out of the plan based on those numbers.
You've got to add that third on top of the people that are already retired.
On slide 12, kind of ways to start the cost reduction of the plan design. So, as I've kind of shown before, the current actuarially calculated contribution is about 50% the cost of continuing accruals, and about 50% paying off the existing unfunded liability. Most discussions for reducing costs start with how to reduce that normal cost component, the continuing accruals, because there's generally no way to reduce the existing actuarial liability. That's retirees who are in pay status. You can't cut their benefits, or it would be very difficult to cut their benefits. And so there's no real good way to pay off or to reduce the unfunded actuarial liability without paying it off. But then I also think administrative expenses can be, it's small comparatively, but it can be meaningful to look at that point. So as I mentioned, I think starting on 13, plan design can be open and have a variety of discussion points. But in order to kind of keep things focused, I think it'd be best to think about what employees or participants can be affected. There are the current employees that you have or the new employees. There's also, for your plan, a split between what I call general service and safety. That's kind of a split defined in Oregon law. The safety employees are the police and fire, as defined in state law. There are some quirks about that group of people, as I'll discuss later, but everybody else are considered general service. And then it's also good to keep in mind, what are your objectives with any new plan design? Like, what are you trying to accomplish? Reducing cost, yes, obviously, but what else are you hoping to attain in the new plan? What are your goals there? And then with anything, you can come up with a really complex, wonderful solution, but if it's a pain to administer, it may not work out as well as you want. So that's something to consider, that especially for a relatively small group of employees, 100 employees, you don't want to build a space shuttle. Sorry for the analogy, but probably best to do what works in the most simplest way to contain that cost. Moving on then, you probably saw this already because you received the material already. Oregon law has had several state Supreme Court decisions where, I'm not a lawyer, I'll say that right off the bat, and so this is obviously a question for the trust counsel ultimately, but we understand at Milliman that it's generally difficult to change the plan for current employees, their benefit structure, their accrual rates. I don't want to be too strong on that opinion because it's legal counsel, but back in the early 90s when there was a plan design change, that's when we dropped the accrual rate from 3.5% to 2.4% for general service employees. The idea there was keep the structure of the plan for the existing employees, but then for only new employees drop the accrual rate. So it's something that you've dealt with in the past, is to try to maintain the expectation of the current employees instead of trying to change it for them. I talk about the decision in 2015 for Morrow versus the state of Oregon. The Supreme Court threw down a bunch of PERS adjustments specifically to the COLA rate. The Oregon legislature had passed a law that would reduce the COLA increases for all employees, including existing retirees. And if that had held, that would have reduced the liability for everybody, for the current retirees and for the current employees. But the Supreme Court said you can't do that. And so that kind of backs up my prior statement that it's generally nothing has gone through Oregon, at least, that was able to reduce the existing liability for existing people. That's what I'm kind of trying to illustrate there. So generally, these discussions talk about changing the plan for new employees only, for new hires. So the existing employees, you know, can maintain their expectation, but new employees have a different structure. The catch of that is that cost savings are then realized over a much longer period of time. That said, if you have a big group of employees that are looking to be retired, then the time would be now to make a change so that their replacements would be under the new plan. So if you kind of see a hump, then you also see a group of new employees coming in. So maybe now is the time. It's a good time to think about, you know, what the plan should look like going forward for the people who replace the existing employees who are getting ready to retire. And then talking about the difference between general service and safety, the plan already kind of has a different benefit structure for the two groups. The police and fire generally have a richer benefit. They earn a benefit that's 3% of their final average pay, whereas the general service get 2.4% of their final average pay. And there are certain restrictions about how low you can go for the safety people. So, but not the general service. So you can't cut the safety people too much, as described on the next page, page 15. In Oregon, there's what's called the equal to or better than test, where municipalities, public entities who have their own retirement plan that employ and include safety employees, but don't participate in PERS, have to pass the equal to or better than test, which says the benefits that your plan offers is at least as good as what they would have gotten if they were part of PERS. And so the effect of that is that basically you can't cut the benefits more than what they would have been in PERS for new people going forward. Now the plan passes this test, and it has been for its entire life, which generally shows that the plan is more generous than PERS has been. But that does, you know, offer a framework for how you could go, how low you could go on just the safety people.
Does this come up through some safety employee lobby? Is that how this comes to
It's by, been around.
By HR retrospective, given the
headlines. Yeah, I mean, it's been around since the 80s, you know, long before my time. So, it's just the idea that, you know, the safety people should be expected to get, you know, this at least per benefit.
Yeah, or unions.
The next couple pages, at least in the printed version that I have, is something that we've produced before, and I'm not going to go into all of it. It compares the Morrill County Retirement Plan and the OPSERP. OPSERP is the PERS current tier level. So new employees would be in the OPSERP. It's not the tier one, tier two. And so you can kind of see that generally the Morrill County Retirement Plan, you know, has 3%, whereas OPSERP currently is 1.8%. So you can see, you know, some of the differences between the plans and how your plan is generally more valuable. So the defined benefit formula percentage, 3% compared to 1.8. The normal retirement age, you have 70, whereas they're 65 or 60 for public safety, but on the next page, the earliest unreduced retirement age. So you have a normal retirement age of 70, but you can retire unreduced at 60 compared to 60 for PERS. So that's how you match it. It's unreduced at 60 for PERS. Yeah, that's a great question. So the retirement plan defines something called the normal retirement age. Now, it's not trying to say like you have to retire at this age, but it says the normal retirement age is 70, and that's basically just the peg at which everything else is measured against. So it could be 65, it could be 70, it could be whatever. But then any ages less than the normal retirement age are then early retirement because it's less than normal. So if you have an unreduced early retirement benefit, then the benefit that you received has no reductions attached to it. It's the same as if you retire at the normal retirement age. A reduced early retirement would have some sort of reduction built in, 75%, 60%.
So for our family, we just come in quite early.
I'll admit, there's no other plan that I worked on with a 70% normal retirement age, but a 60-year unreduced early retirement age.
It's
kind of, you know, like what was the point? I don't know. I wasn't around when the plan was developed.
So there's another question. Contributions are salary reduction picked up by the county. That seems counter. It's either their salary reduced or...
Yeah, I think what we meant to say there, and sorry if that doesn't make a lot of sense, is that the contributions never go through the employee's hand. They just kind of go straight from...
It's their money.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we understand that the contributions are negotiated as a salary reduction. But it never passes through their hand. It goes straight from the county.
And what does the county put in 6% interest rate guarantee?
The pension plan, the Morrill County Retirement Plan, has an account structure that gets us a guaranteed 6% rate of return every year. The accounts are built up with the employee contributions, with the 6% contribution. And so every year, that account then gets a guaranteed 6% rate of return. At termination or retirement, the employee then can choose to take that account balance out, but forfeit some of the retirement, some of the annuity benefit that they had also accrued. So if they choose to leave the account in the plan, they get the full value of the benefit. If they take the account out, then they get a reduced benefit, but that account grows with a guaranteed system.
So we are better off if given the option of hiring somebody in the safety class or other, we are better off to hire them in the other. But by that I mean, you know, I'm thinking like an emergency manager or an SRO. Is there flexibility there? What defines that?
Such as the emergency manager doesn't have to be the sheriff's office.
Yeah.
Right. The emergency manager could be something else, and therefore would not be considered. Well, I'd have to check to see if it.
You see where I'm headed.
I think we have one who is not, but the rest are
current. Yeah. So I'd have to check to see if an emergency manager would be considered a public safety.
If you would.
But like the SROs.
So yeah, that's kind of what I was saying. Is like,
hey, sorry to get off that. It's a position, not the person. Carry on.
Okay, I think maybe starting at 16. That, and you know, we kind of go over plan design type stuff. So there, and this is where you can get off the rails if you want or if you don't. I'll kind of start going, and you can tell me what you want to do going forward. There are generally two types of retirement plans. There is one called the defined benefit plan, and the other is a defined contribution plan. The current plan is a defined benefit because we say we're going to promise you a benefit for the rest of your life after you retire based on a formula of years worked, final average pay. And so that's a promise. The defined contribution is a little bit of the opposite, where we promise we'll put a certain amount of money in, and then that'll grow with whatever the rates of return are. But then at the end, when you retire, it's up to the employee participant to pay that out. There's no life guaranteed income. There's no, you know, guaranteed benefit amount. It just, it's based on the contribution of the county puts in. And there are fundamentally, you know, differences between these two types of plans. DB plans are generally viewed as the most efficient in terms of providing benefit in retirement for cost up front. So a dollar that you contribute now in a DB plan generally produces more benefit in retirement than a dollar contributed to a DC plan, a defined contribution plan, because the defined benefit plan is able to average out and reduce certain risks that the defined contribution plan can. But that's also arguable because it depends on actual experience throughout the years. In a stretch of good returns, it looks like the DC plan will beat out a defined benefit plan because the contribution, the account balance is growing much quicker. But you know, that's one of the fundamental differences there. The next page kind of highlights a couple other differences between a defined benefit and defined contribution plan. Defined benefit plans, you get an income for life. There's some mechanisms that are, you know, reward long-term employment or reward, you know, sticking around for a while. And based on early retirement rules and rates, you can kind of manage when people retire. So going back to the example of unreduced at 60, you're basically saying, hey, if you want to have a unreduced retirement at 60, then you're encouraging people to retire when they reach age 60. If you were to increase that to an unreduced at 65, say, then you're encouraging them to wait until 65 to retire. That's what I mean by it. You can encourage certain retirement patterns. Defined benefit plans are obviously more volatile for contributing and funding. They can become unfunded. They go, you know, sometimes more expensive, sometimes less expensive. And the plan sponsor, the county, bears most of the risk of being underfunded, but also bears most of the reward of, you know, a good investment return. Defined contribution plans, on the other hand, have an accumulation, but that the participants must manage. There's no guaranteed benefit or guaranteed lifetime benefit. You know, money can run out before you die. But they are, you know, generally more stable cost to the plan sponsor, to the county. You say, I'm going to contribute 6%, and no matter what assets do, no matter what, you know, participants do, you pay 6%. It doesn't change. There's no volatility there. But on that hand, the participants then bear all the risks and the rewards of that benefit plan. Any kind of questions then about the fundamentally two different types of retirement plans? The next page, I kind of say, you know, assuming that you don't want to have any radical change in the way the plan is built, you don't want to go to a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan for new employees or something else, you know, where are some areas where the plan could be changed and reduce some costs? And this is kind of tied to where it's more valuable than say, employees. And so I kind of say, you know, unreduced early retirement age, you know, you could start with 60 or 55, you could push it up. the automatic cost of living adjustment is currently guaranteed maximum 2%. You could lower that. The OPSERV level right now is 1.25% on the first $60,000, and then a negligible 0.15% on anything over that. So you can reduce that COLA increase, cost of living adjustment increase. Or the benefit multiplier, the 2.4%, 3%, that's what got modified back in the early 90s and was reduced to save some money going forward. And there's room to reduce that going forward as well. And then there's a couple of benefits. I mentioned the $60 supplemental benefit. If an employee works for 8 years, they get a $60 benefit, no COLA increase on it, but just $60 for the rest of their life, starting at age 65. Slide 19 says, okay, maybe you do want to go a little, farther out. You don't want to just modify the plan, What's maybe the farthest you could go? I'm not recommending any of these, but, you could elect to join PERS. You could say for new employees going forward, because the existing employees, they kind of have what they have. But for new employees going forward, they'll be part of PERS, and you can elect to join PERS for their new employees. And you wouldn't have to worry about the equal to or better than test because the safety employees would be in PERS. So of course they equal PERS. The contribution rates for an OPSERV level are currently around 15% or so, plus a 6% contribution from the employee. So that is less than the current rate. The big headline numbers for PERS contribution rates are like, oh my gosh, they're going up to 30%. But that's because it includes all the really expensive Tier 1, Tier 2 people. As a new PERS member, theoretically, you would be at the much cheaper OPSERV level. But there are advantages and disadvantages to being part of PERS. And you wouldn't have to necessarily put all employees in PERS. You could put just safety employees in PERS. So you manage that equal to or better than test issue, and then the general service people have an even cheaper plan, a DC plan, something like a 401k that would be even cheaper than PERS would be. You could go there. Again, I'm not recommending this. I'm just trying to these two slides. I'm trying to put a bookend on the discussion. You can modify an existing plan, or you can go as far as you want. Generally, yeah. I think, again, it's legal counsel question. I don't think you can probably modify the plan for existing employees.
And I've reached out to the plan attorney. I haven't heard back from him yet. How does this apply?
The Morrow decision, the name kind of gets mixed up. The Morrow decision did allow the COLA to change for future accruals for existing employees. So that was one win in that decision. So the current employees in PERS were going to get a guaranteed 2%, but the Supreme Court said, no, you can lower that for future accruals into the future. So what you've accrued now will get 2%, but what you accrue into the future will get the 1.25%. So that is an area that you could modify probably for existing employees. The last page is kind of a next steps. If we want to continue this conversation, what can we do? It's kind of laying out how we think the discussion could go. The pace at which and the steps are generally up to you, but we're willing and able and ready to help you in however you want that discussion to go. And that was basically all I had for my time. Yes.
Good. Well. so we have this plan. I'm trying to, in my mind, think of, okay, if we change the plan, because right now we're underfunded, the number just keeps growing. Yeah. And there's some possible plan that maybe gets us closer to not being underfunded. I'm not fully confident about that. Right. So if we change the plan and take away these new people from contributing to this current plan in some fashion, doesn't that make this unfunded liability thing worse? That's wrong.
Yeah.
So because you don't have potentially new money going into the old plan, right? Is that reasonable to assume?
You still have all the current employees contributing right. Going into the old plan.
Right, so, but I feel like we're in the Social Security plan. That we got these new people paying in, but all this money is going out. Because I, well, little I was able to look at we have more money going out than we have coming in already. And then we have less money coming in. So that's what my concern is.
Yeah, and I think that's something that is reasonable to think about. I think because the 6% contribution for existing employees already isn't covering the cost of their accruals, their accruing benefit that's worth more than 6% of their pay, that difference, taking that away, would help control the growth of liabilities into the future. Paying down that fund is just going to be something that you have to, you know, do over a 20-year amortization basis. But stopping the continued growth of that is what you get from sort of changing the plan. So I think that maybe as an example, so the normal cost rate as of 716 is about 15%. Changing the plan could reduce that for new employees or get rid of it for new employees. And so the overall rate would then go down 14%. And if more new employees enter the plan under the new structure, then that cost of continued accruals would eventually, like if they're not in the plan anymore, if they're going to PERS, that normal cost rate will eventually reduce to zero. Because everybody would be higher than that. Because the new benefit structure would not be a 15% of pay benefit structure. It would be something less. And so as you're getting the new people rolled into the new plan, then that cost goes down into the future.
That's kind of, it takes a long time to get there.
I think that's the unfortunate side of not being able to modify the plan for the current employees, is that it does require turnover to see cost savings.
The whole block has to travel through together.
But if you've got a big group, if you think, and generally people who have been around a long time, they have high benefits, they have high liability. If you see them, looking to retire, then being able to replace them with somebody at a lower cost structure.
We should go out and hire a bunch of new employees, young ones, a whole bunch of them.
I mean, if you need
them. If you're going to anyway.
Oh, well, sure.
Well, and really what we're faced with is our cost in this program pretty high. New employees, if you're in your 20s, early 20s, starting out, you're worried more about what do I get my paycheck today, and then 30 years in the future, when you haven't lived 30 years yet in your whole lifetime, that's a really long time. And that's what we're really facing is on new hires, they look at what the county can afford to pay and what they get their paycheck. And it's not as much as what private enterprise puts in their paycheck what they get.
And, which is probably kind of funny because the county is putting in so much more than what they're actually being taken out of their paycheck.
When I look at what the overall package is for county employees, we've got to take into consideration all the benefits of the day. And I know our $20 an hour employee really costs us $35 an hour, and in private enterprise, that $20 an hour employee is costing $47 an hour. And so, how do I compete to get that $20 an hour employee that wants, they want money now, they've got a mortgage to make, they've got young kids that are thinking about having kids, and that want to put groceries on the table now, they're not thinking about retirement 30 years from now when they haven't lived that long to begin with yet. That's too far out there. That's the conundrum I keep coming to, is how we lower the cost of this plan for the millennial group that they're deciding something more than 5 years away.
So should we take a quick break and come back for phase two? That's okay. Or was there more questions for
Well, that sounds good for me.
Okay, 10 and break, we'll come back in 3 years shortly after. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.